okay. All right, but yes, sorry.
The reason why I asked whether are we starting with questions, I thought that the procedure was that we were going to allow Mike to make a presentation so that if any of the questions that might arise, if they are not covered in the slides, can be asked after, and then he responds to those questions after. But now we have prioritized questions, so I'm not even sure whether how is he going to go about first responding to these questions and then going to the presentations, and we might find ourselves getting a duplication of the same issues. Because I presuppose some of the questions emanate from the discussions we had in the previous discussion. That's why I asked first, are we starting with the question? So I thought we were going
to... Why? You're not listening, with due respect to you. You see, we agreed last time that there were many questions that were not responded to, and there were many further questions that committee members had. But because of the limited time, we agreed that members will send written questions.
Can I
finish and just inform you why the process is logically following the course it is. So they did submit questions. And the first item on the agenda is, there's no need to answer the question. He's answered it already in written form. So members were asked...
Chair, I'm not sure that covers all of us. Maybe it covers you and David.
It's a decision of the meeting. It's not my decision. You should propose it. Here are the answers.
I don't agree with that.
Yeah, well, that's unfortunate, but here we are. There are answered questions. Now, we said to members, instead of him going through all the answers, we take it people are content with the answers unless there's something that they lack certainty about. Then we discovered that David had also put written questions. And unfortunately, something went wrong on Treasury side. It seems they did not give written answers. Had they given the written answers, then all we had to do was ask them, do you have any follow-up questions?
Were those questions with us? I have never seen them.
Yes, they were sent to you.
They were
received by all of them.
I've not seen that.
Well, unfortunately, once again, you have to check your email system. We can't do more.
No, I didn't receive them.
No, as usual, every time you said that, we showed it to you. Alan, can you show it to you that you sent it to us?
Chair, can I finish the point
all right,
I
having said that, now you are free to speak. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's very...
It's logical, but we do it always like this.
What is logical to you is not logical to me, but it doesn't matter. All I'm asking is that it will be good to have the presentation and then get those questions, because the last time National Treasury was not even here to respond to, that's why you said to the lady who was sitting there that you have wanted a preliminary response, but it was not there, so I thought it was going to be here, but nevertheless, you have decided...
There are two separate issues. The one is the public hearings to which you're going to respond. Is that right, Michael Sachs? That happened on Wednesday. These are the issues that follow from there. Two items on the agenda. We're dealing with item one. Can we just focus on item one? These are the questions members have. The item two is the public hearings to which you will respond and to which your colleague couldn't respond on Wednesday. So can we deal with the questions that were asked by members? That's item one on the agenda. That's what we're focusing on. And that's the way we normally do it. And if members want to change that process, we can do it henceforth. Right. On item one, you want to follow up? Have you got any follow-up questions on item one? Right. Do you want to respond? Good. Fine. Colleagues, item two is the public hearings. Welcome, Mr. Nchilengwa. Nice to see you.
With regards to the press, the questions posed by Honourable Mania now, I think it's, you know, every budget process, there is an elaborate, complex set of interactions that involve officials, members of cabinet, officials from different departments, the Minister's Committee of the Budget, and we have many discussions, and that's how we prepare a budget, and in the course of which many proposals are made and discussed, and some are agreed and others are not agreed. So that is kind of what the budget process is. So what we have presented in the MTBPS, we took to cabinet, and it is an MTBPS of the whole of cabinet. And I can't really... maybe it's the other questions are maybe political, and you can ask to a political office bearer in terms of why did cabinet take particular decisions and not take other decisions. I would suggest that be posed to members of cabinet.
point I'm making is not a question about the decisions. The question here is the absence of decisions. There were no decisions.
I tend to agree with Mike. I don't know what we want Mike to do. Mike doesn't sit in cabinet. If a cabinet take a decision that is contrary to what National Treasury wish for, you can't come here and ask officials of National Treasury to respond to what cabinet should have decided. And David is just playing to the gallery. The issue is we can only get responses that relate to the policy decisions that has been set and has been accepted by both cabinet and the department. So any other issue that belongs to cabinet, the minister must be called here. He can ask those questions to the minister. Then we can entertain them. And that's why I asked you, because I know strategically where David was going, because that's what he wanted to do. And we allow him to do these things all the time. And sometimes some of us will not take it, that he take this approach, as if it's a collective decision of the committee to approach matters in the manner in which it does. Why should Mike come and respond on behalf of the cabinet in terms of whether fiscal consultation is there or not?
Yeah. Okay, look, I think, Michael, you've answered the question. For now, there's nothing further. It's a question, if you want, you can put to the minister in the House, or the next time the minister comes here, you can raise it. Tandy's right about that. But on the separation of the two issues on that one, That's something that I think Tanya and I disagree. We deal with item one. I'm not going to repeat, right? Not the public hearings, the questions that people asked for out of the previous meeting. Where it overlaps with what you're going to say in response to the public hearings, you can say, look, I'm coming to that. Right. Thank you. Right. Alf, you wanted to ask something, Mr. Lees? Quickly.
Okay. Has there been a change in fiscal policy? That's how I understood the second meeting. I would say that the most important factor is the change in circumstances that we face. So over the last 5 years, as we indicated in the book, we have been achieving consolidation. The primary balance has been closing. That's the difference between revenue and non-interest expenditure. Year on year, every year for the last 5 years, the primary balance has been closing. This year, not because policy changed, but because of circumstances that we face, the primary balance began to move in the opposite direction. It is no longer closing. And the primary reason it is no longer closing is because we had a 51 billion rand revenue shortfall this year, which carried through to the future years. And the size of that shortfall is unprecedented. We have not faced a revenue shortfall of this magnitude since the 2009 global financial crisis. In some respects, in relative terms, you could even say that the shortfall this year is bigger than that. In 2009, when we faced that shortfall, we had very low levels of debt to GDP, and we had significant fiscal space. So, you know, in conclusion, what I'll say is fiscal policy always changes every year in response to changing circumstances. This year, the circumstances changed quite dramatically, and therefore the response has been a different framework. The third question about the size of the adjustment, you are correct. When we say 40 billion, we are talking about what would be required over and above everything that is already in the current fiscal framework. So the revenue and the expenditure lines that you see there, which also include previous adjustments announced in previous budgets. So for instance, there's a 15 billion rand revenue measures that are in the framework. That is not part of the 40 billion. The 40 billion is additional effort that we estimate would be required to stabilize the debt-to-GDP ratio below 60%. On the issues of the public sector debt and the contingent liabilities, we provide a wealth of detail on those issues in the budget review. We have not, we don't update those. There's some information that we update in the budget review and we don't update in the MPPS. That is one set of information that we do develop our own internal, we track these things, but there are processes, annual reports and corporate plans of state-owned companies that have to come through the process, so it only makes sense really to update them on an annual basis. So we will provide a full statement of all of those issues again in the budget review in February. What I would add is that, with the question of guarantees, it's actually required in the Constitution that government report fully and on its guarantee portfolio. And I am of the view that there could be a better mechanism through which the executive reports to the legislature about any new guarantees that may or may not have been issued. So as far as I'm aware, I mean, just because I sit on the committee in Treasury that processes those things, there isn't any like major new development since the budget in terms of guarantee exposure or new guarantees issued. I may be wrong, but I can't. There's nothing that sticks in my mind. However, perhaps whenever we issue a guarantee, there should be a formal process of submitting some kind of mechanism report to Parliament about it. I think that's something that Parliament can consider, and it would be well within its rights to request.
These responses are not, two of the responses are not adequate. The whole question on the change in fiscal policy and the response that there's a change in circumstance, I accept that. But what makes this MDBPS an outlier is that there was in fact no change in response. What there was nothing. That's what, and I want to get to an explanation of why that is the case. That's the first point. The second point is, I simply don't accept that because Treasury compile data and choose on their own terms to disclose it,
I also have a point of order,
etc. I requested the information.
This is not a point of order.
Legal basis.
These are follow-up questions. This is not a point of order, and I don't think you should allow it.
Disclose that information. This committee decided that we wanted contingent liabilities every quarter. The Treasury is not compliant.
Chair, I'm not going to repeat that this was not a point of order, but let me go to the point. Because, Mike, there's something that you need to clarify. At least they have an impression that you're supposed to come here on a quarterly basis and present the reviews that has been made. Can you explain to them, after the MTBPS, in terms of the guarantees and the liabilities, what is the process that's supposed to unfold? You made a suggestion in the current that perhaps National Treasury should brief Parliament as and when there's a change in terms of the guarantees. So maybe that's the thing that we might want to discuss and see how, because also the issue is what my experience has been, how members of Parliament handle that information when it comes to them. They have never handled it with the sensitivity that it deserves. They have actually used that information against government to campaign politically for their parties, when actually it's sensitive information that belongs to the
Chairman. Chairman, on a point of order, this is actually out of order now, Mr. Chairman.
So,
in what sense is it out of order?
It's out of order because we're dealing with questions, and we now have...
I'm suggesting a process. There's nothing out of order on what I'm doing.
Please, Tandy, it's his right. The rules are the same, Tandy, you chaired before. He has a right, and he's raising a point of order, Tandy, please.
Let me listen to the point of order,
Chairman. Yeah, let's listen to his point. I don't think it's a point of order, but go for it. What's the point of order?
Chairman, we're on the agenda discussing, dealing with questions, and Tandy is now accusing us of using information irresponsibly.
Order, that's a view.
I'm
ruling it's not a point of order. Tandy, can you finish? That's a view.
In that case, then, I'm going to make my views.
It's my view. They want their views to be listened to, and they don't want our views to be listened to. I'm making a suggestion, and it's a suggestion that I know it will fit all of us, including themselves, to say we'll look at it as Parliament as to how we will deal with issues that are going to be major policy changes. Because sometimes they catch us off guard and we're left behind in terms of the things that we ourselves approve of. It's a matter we'll discuss. Let's park it for later discussions. Thanks.
I agree with Tandy, actually. The thing is that what you are suggesting is something new, And I think it's something we should take seriously. I think it settles the issue. Can we also move on to Mr. Lees, because we'll move on to item two, which is a response to the public hearing. So, also on item three, a brief one about processing MTBPS and budget. And we've got flights.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that I would differ with Tandy in terms of the process. This committee, as I understand it, took a decision that the National Treasury would report to us quarterly about the contingent liabilities. So I'm not sure why Tandy is scared of us taking on the government. That's our role as the opposition, and that's the way that politics works. So it's not necessary to come here and try and score political points like that. If that's what we're going to do here, well, that's fine. I can attack the ANC just as much as Tandy can attack me and the DA. I think that as committee members, we normally work very well together in terms of focusing on the issues, and robustly so. Whether the way we do that robustly is appreciated by some members of the committee, then it's up to them to withdraw and leave the committee if they don't like the way that I do it, and I'm sure Tandy won't do that, Mr. Chairman. Now, let's get down to business, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, is that a point of order, Alfie? You can respond to her.
Yeah,
robustly. Is that a point? Please stop stupid point of orders here.
The point is taken, Mr. Chairman.
Good, Tandy. I don't know why she's laughing.
Yeah, I laugh because I'm a happy fellow, Mr. Chairman, most of the time. You've seen me cross a couple of times, and I'm now wasting valuable time. But yeah, let's move on. The David has covered some of the questions that I wanted to just follow up on, so I'm going to just look at my favourite topic, Mr. Chairman, which thank you very much for the answers received. There's no prize for those who guess what it is, Mr. Chairman. I'd get the prize, I think. Can you confirm, Michael? And I'm not casting aspersions on your IQ or your abilities and so on, but maybe it's outside your domain, but. Perhaps you can confirm that Citibank, apparently, according to the memo from the minister, entered into a repayment schedule of the 1.8 billion, which required 700 million paid at the end of September, and then payments going through until April 2019. Now, what I'm not sure about is that agreement in place, which would mean that SAA is sitting with the 1.1 billion rand that was allocated for the payment. A total of 1.8 billion was allocated for Citibank. Citibank's arrangement was a payment of 700 million rand by the end of September, and then various other payments. So all I'm asking really is, was the 1.8 billion paid to Citibank or wasn't it? Because on the one hand, there's an agreement not to pay it, but then Treasury paid the full amount to SAA. So some clarity on that. Because the answer here to my question is, you've got in front of you, to meet the payment of 1.8 billion due to on the 29th of September, and then 1.2 billion of working capital. Then the other answer that I'm not entirely clear about, in terms of the domestic lenders, they required an equity injection, but it's not stated how much. Is that the 10 billion? Because somewhere else there's a 3 billion figure when you look at the domestic lenders. They insisted on a 3 billion figure. So I'm not clear exactly what that equity injection is. It's under point 12 of my questions, I think. Mr. Chairman, it saddens me a little bit because over the last 2 months we've talked a lot about this meeting taking place today. And I was concerned when the letter came from, or report from the minister to say it was a special meeting. But I think that all of us were under the impression it was the AGM. But the National Treasury never put us right at our various meetings. I think even you, Mr. Chairman, referred to it as an AGM. Certainly it was reported in the press that you'd said that, but I don't have the Hansard or whatever. But the point I'm trying to make is that it's sad that in those discussions, National Treasury doesn't appear to have once said, listen guys, the meeting on the 3rd of November is not an AGM. The annual financials or the annual report will not be ready. The AGM is not going to take place in 2019. It's now going to take place sometime in 2017. It's now going to take place sometime in 2018. And I would really ask, when we're sitting together in a meeting like this and we say something that is clearly wrong, I personally, anyway, would appreciate you saying, sorry, Alf, whatever you want to call me, I don't care, as long as it's not late for dinner. That's not the way it is. It's going to be a special meeting, and at that meeting, the board is going to be reconstructed, and the AGM will happen later. Because the impact of that is that it's not just not putting us right. They're putting me right. Let's forget about what other people thought or didn't think. I don't know what they thought. But what was said by National Treasury on more than one occasion, and I think perhaps even the ministers, was that Mr. Nguyen had to stay on until the AGM to present the annual report. And that's clearly not happened. So to me it's very sad that National Treasury, if that's the case, maybe I'm confusing the ministry with the Treasury, didn't actually clear this up and make it clear to everyone. And I'm expressing my disappointment, Mr. Chairman. I'm not expecting Michael to respond to that. It's just it's not nice to know that National Treasury would do something like that. Just to confirm, then perhaps you can confirm that in fact the meeting is taking or has taken place. It was due to take place at 8 o'clock this morning, and that the new board now is in place. That would be nice to know. Mr. Chairman, the question 16, another disappointment with National Treasury, I'm afraid. I asked whether the interest rates on the lenders, on the loans from the domestic lenders, had changed as a consequence of the rollovers. And the answer I get, we all get, Mr. Chairman, is these are confidential agreements entered into between the lenders and SAA. Not acceptable. Not acceptable. I did not actually, which I should have done, I did not ask for the actual interest rates. I simply asked whether they had changed. And that was a failure on my part. But you can't even answer that question. So, Mr. Chairman, I would like that question answered, please. Then, in terms of the $10 billion, just from a practical point of view, I assume that's going to be an equity injection. So what are we doing? Are we issuing more shares in SAA? How is it going to be handled in the actual equity of the company? It's just me interested because that's my history of whatever. Then the last question, Mr. Chairman, is that I've talked about some of the conditions that the domestic lenders require to be met in order to extend their loans or roll them over. There's a rollover to the 31st of March 2019 in reported by the Minister and now also you. Have all the conditions been met, and is there a formal agreement from the domestic lenders now to roll over to the 31st of March 2019?
Before anybody else speaks, I just need to remind the committee, because that's my job as the chair. We're told it's an AGM, Michael. I don't think you have to answer this, but just to be clear, colleagues, just remember, we were told it's an AGM. We had a lot of discussion about whether it's possible to have an AGM, because at that stage they were talking about bringing in an appropriation bill. And as the DA, it doesn't matter who raises the thing, if people are correct, they're correct. The DA said, how are you going to have an AGM on the 3rd of November if you're going to bring an appropriation bill here on the 25th of October. And we even issued a statement which we adopted, a resolution, which speaks of saying this committee wants the AGM held on the 3rd of November. Colleagues, I just want to remind members, we all agreed to that. So let's not quibble about it. So the truth is, it's not, Mr. Lees, your subjective interpretation, as you well know. It's the meeting's view. We have it in writing. We had Treasury officials speaking about the AGM and you people speaking about the AGM and ANC members. So can I remind members, let's not now have an argument about did Mr. Lees understand it right or not, because we've taken a decision on it. It's in our BRRR, it talks of an AGM. Mr. Lees, you're absolutely right. Now, having said that, can members raise their concerns? I see Tandi's hand up.
Chair.
You can finish quickly, it's fine. Tandi can come in. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, just clarity on the sale of the Telkom shares. Are they going to be sold or they're not going to be sold, and how much is going to be sold?
Just one more thing as a chair, I have to remind members. The rules require that the members of the executive or the officials have to reply to questions. If they cannot give an answer because there are market sensitivities or there are legal challenges, they have to say, we cannot give you this information, it's confidential because of the following reasons. Any member from any party can challenge that, then it goes to Frank Jenkins and the team. So I don't know, Michael, whether your answer is correct or not, but in terms of parliamentary rules, you may be right in saying that, but you have to then explain why it's confidential. Thank you very much. Those are rules that I haven't shaped, colleagues and comrades. They're not my rules. I'm not even that rules committee. They're the parliament's rules. Thank you. Over to you, Tandi.
Chair, I remember that you studied psychology, but one thing that I want you to take you to the grave is that you will never predict me. I'm very unpredictable, so don't try to read much into my mind. You won't be able to do it. Okay, let me go to the issues. And I want Elf to listen because, you see, he's the only member of the DA I take seriously.
I cannot agree more.
You see, so I want you to listen when I speak. No, not this one. You see. Chair, partly I'm going to agree with Elf, and I'm doing something that I don't do most of the cases. I picked up that the AG is intending to take SARS to court or the other way around. I don't know. It relates to annual statements and so on. Now, I'm going to be worried in an event that having been assured that on the 3rd of November it will be an AGM, and the AGM is not taking place. Now, my suspicion is that the annual financial statements and the annual report is not ready, and we will deal with that when it comes. Maybe we'll deal with that differently. I know Elf is already predicting that that's the case, and you know, and then and we'll deal with it when it comes. I agree with
the 27th, Andy. 27th, it'll be here.
Yeah. So I agree with him on that one. Secondly, I think he's entitled to get a response in relation to whether the interest rates in terms of the domestic lenders has changed or not. It's not an issue whether we should debate it or not. That's why I said earlier on, and I still insist on that, you know, well, he's measured. He doesn't do it for those reasons. But others do it for that reason. And when it happens, Chair, I'll be the first one to remind you, to say, here is this man doing this thing that I said he will do. And I'll be different. Sometimes I'm very diplomatic. On that day, I'm not going to be diplomatic about the intention of certain people. I believe there are issues that we would have wanted to engage the minister further on. You see how we do the briefings after the MTVPS sometimes doesn't give us this latitude to go deeper,
yeah,
issue by issue. So we should find a way of doing it. Maybe in a closed session we get the gloves off and then we don't invite many people, we do it. And I know Elf will agree on that one when I say we do it in closed doors, but not David. David is not going to agree with that. He's going to invite the whole world to see it. And then we do that. So I'm leaving it to you to see how we do it. Given the limitations of what I can say in relation to whether it's fiscal consolidation or not and so on and so forth. I know you understand me, sometimes you are very difficult, but you know where I'm going. To make sure that how we do it helps us, that I don't find myself being turned into an infantile as I deal with it. Thanks.
Anything else? Right. Mr. Delic.
Thank you, Chairperson. Michael, just a couple of questions. On the affordability of nuclear, I read your response, but can we just get it in sort of clear, unambiguous terms? It is currently, as we understand it, currently not affordable. So currently, with the cost of the nuclear option, it cannot be done in the current financial circumstances. So do we conclude, therefore, that it will not be done until such time as it is deemed to be affordable? That's the first question. As it currently stands, obviously there are political changes that you know, that lie ahead that could bring about changed decisions in any event. Second question really is back to the SAA. There is a bit of confusion here. Not only the fact that we were told that the 3rd of November is the AGM. Could you just clarify, Michael, when you respond to the question, does Dudu Mnyeni remain on the SAA board as its chair until the 3rd of November, your answer is yes. Does that therefore mean that the new board that was announced is not the new board yet? Because the new board was announced with Mnyeni as the chair. So therefore, there is no new board yet. And are you suggesting it comes into being on the 3rd of November, which is not an AGM? So by implication, it's suggesting that you don't need an AGM because you say she ceases to be the chairperson of the board on the 3rd of November. Therefore, you're saying it doesn't need to be an AGM for her to cease being the chairperson of the board and for the new board to take effect. Then the third question is on SARS. I was just trying to get it in front of me, but somewhere on the question on SARS, you say yourself, sorry, question four, okay. As you said, I mean, what makes this MTBPS particularly difficult is the almost 51 billion rand shortfall, tax revenue shortfall. You know, there are various views about what are the causes of the shortfall. What the minister said is that it's, you know, the economic slowdown. I think most of us would have a slightly different view and say it's probably a combination of a variety of factors. The economic slowdown, we need to address the causes of the economic slowdown. There may be other causes. And some possible inefficiencies in tax collection. But the revenue shortfall, you yourself said, is a serious problem. And so we need to have a stronger answer than this on what is to be done to address the revenue shortfall. So you, in answer to the question about whether there will be additional taxes, you say, well, maybe. We don't announce that now. But one way or other, there need to be, you know, the considerations have to be very serious about what happens to address the shortfall. Otherwise, we will get deeper into debt, or the gap between revenue and expenditure is going to grow. If either that, or we have to drastically reduce expenditure. So without increasing revenue, that gap will grow. It would have to be a very serious exercise, Michael, to see how we can increase revenue, and your answer is a little bit shallow with respect to that. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Because we need to round up now from section one. Yes, Mr. Lee had some outstanding question.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be as quick as I can. I just want to apologize because my memory must be very bad, but in terms of the interest rates, I did actually ask for them, so it's silly. But, Mr. Chairman, in terms of the it seems that if you read their response I'm not sure how to direct you to it, but it's on tax brackets, consider increasing CIT. There seems to be a reluctance built in there to increase CIT because of negative consequences. And then if you look at the response to my question three, at the bottom of the paragraph, the elasticity of 1.2 for personal income tax in 2016-17 shows that additional revenues can still be achieved through policy changes. So am I right in kind of getting a picture that National Treasury would prefer to go the personal income tax rate rather than the CIT, because the CIT has consequences for base erosion and moving profits out of our jurisdiction to lower taxes, where many other jurisdictions are now reducing their company's tax? Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
No. You raise stupid points of order as it applies to other members, except for Derek. That's a problem. But I mean, I don't think you should be defensive. It's your right to ask these questions, whether I approve of them or not. I have no authority to stop you. What I want to say, though, Derek, in reply to you and to Mr. Lees, for what it's worth, right, on 9 o'clock radio, SAFM, it said there was a meeting of the SAA today. I didn't say it was a special meeting. It said Dudu Mieni has stepped down. In fact, the headline at 9 o'clock news was Dudu Mieni is no more. I mean, the SAFM reporter was almost gloating, right? And that raises issues now about whether a reporter should speak like that. But anyway, that she's no more there. So I can only tell you what I heard about the 9 o'clock news. So there was a meeting this morning, and I got an SMS saying there was a meeting also. So there was a meeting. Ms. Mieni is no more the board chair. But Derek is right to say, therefore, it's wrong to say that her departure is linked to an AGM. Now, the issues about the AGM, I don't think it's fair to burden you with that. You were not here, but you can reply. The other thing to say, in fairness, there are some aspects of the questions raised by members you might want to give in written form. But because we have to vote on this report on Tuesday next, we would plead with you that you submit them by latest Sunday afternoon, because the two chairs need it by Sunday evening so we can give it to members by noon on Monday. So if you can give the written replies by then. Over to you, and then we draw this to a close and move on to item two.
Unfortunately, I'm not very close to the deliberations about SAA within National Treasury, so and my IQ might not be what it appears to be. Well, I'm actually, I think EQ is more important.
Good point. Can you address that to one Mr. Mania in particular? But
yeah. Okay. So what I can confirm, as I've been sitting here in communication with people who know more than me, is that indeed the meeting did take place this morning, and a new board is now in place. And the inaugural meeting of the new board will be on the 7th of November. And that I can also confirm that it was a special meeting and not an AGM. As regards to the status of the transfer on SAA's books, it should appear there as shareholders' equity. So from a kind of formal point of view, we don't give money for Citibank. We're capitalizing SAA, and then it's within the purview of SAA to see how they manage their books. But as is mentioned in the text of the answer, some of that capitalization was intended by SAA to meet payments due on the 29th of September, and another part of it was for working capital.
Can I make a follow-up on that? Because F raised a very fundamental question. You see, if money that has been allocated specifically for working capital and to service this debt, if in any event can be utilized for other reasons, we need to see, to be able to see it in advance. It might appear like that in your books, but I think the question is, can we be guaranteed that it's solely allocated for working capital and to to do exactly what it was intended. Because once it gets into the into the account of SAA and it's not followed through in terms of how it's spent, and I'm not making any insinuation that suggests it will not be spent for what it was intended for, but what is the mechanism within National Treasury to ensure that it actually goes to what it was intended for? Least we find ourselves having to come back and discuss that actually you did not use that. Because by the time we get to the financial statements and we pick up it was not, then it's something else. I don't know whether you catch the point I'm trying to make, Chair.
I've got that one on the lease.
Just a quick addition there, Mr. Chairman, through you to Michael, because why it's particularly of concern, as Tandy has pointed out, is that Section 16 was invoked to make that payment on the basis of an emergency. Now, if the money hasn't been used for that purpose, then where was the emergency?
Any other questions, Michael?
Okay. Just in terms of that supplementary question, some of the funds that we have transferred to SAA were in terms of Section 16. Others were introduced as part of the Adjustment Appropriation Act, as because we there's a clause in the PFMA that allows us to budget for things in the adjustment budget that the minister announces in the budget speech. So the minister in the budget speech said we are looking at options for recapitalizing SAA and the post office. So maybe I'm prepared to admit. Okay. Well, I was going to refer you to, all I'm saying is of the 10 billion. But as I say, I'm not the expert on SAA, and unfortunately, we don't have that person here. In respect of the interest rates and whether there were, as the question that says, has interest rates changed, and if so, what are the details of the interest rates charged as well as the additional cost of interest, I suggest you give me time to go back to the office and see whether, because it may well be that this was just an official not realizing the importance of the question and just assuming that the information is, let's look at it again and see if we can give any supplementary information. On the issue of the Telkom shares, I think I've covered what I need to cover or what I can cover on SAA. Members or the chair will tell me if there's anything in particular, but I will convey obviously to the DG and the minister the concerns about the AGM and that have been raised here, and I would suggest that as the committees or as Parliament considers the adjustment appropriation and calls in SAA for those discussions, that really that's the forum where you would get more detail on these things. But I will certainly convey the sentiments back to the office. On the Telkom shares, the question was whether there's any discrepancy. No, we don't think there's any discrepancy. I mean, the MTBPS left it broadly, saying that we will dispose of assets to make good the breach of the expenditure ceiling. The minister went further in the speech and identified the particular assets we're looking at. As far as I know, they haven't yet been disposed of, and we're still in the technical process of considering that, which also has sensitivities associated with it because we don't want to undermine the value of the asset in the process of disposing of it, if that is to take place. On the questions on SARS and revenue and corporate income tax and personal income tax, I've got a couple of slides on those things, so I'd request to come back to them then. On the affordability of nuclear, I think the minister has made clear on several occasions in public that we cannot afford nuclear at this stage. And not only can the budget not afford it, but the country cannot afford it. The questions were, in our answer, we make reference to the work that we did as National Treasury in 2015. And as we outlined there, the analysis showed that a 9.6 gigawatt nuclear program would have significant implications for national income, the total debt burden, international financial position of the country, the balance of payments for taxpayers and electricity consumers who will bear the full cost of the program. So at the time, our conclusion was really that it would not be prudent or wise to proceed with a 9.6 gigawatt procurement prior to the stabilization of the national debt picture. And to the extent that the national, since we did that work, the stabilization of national debt has been pushed out. All I can say is that over the medium term, we have not allocated resources in the medium term expenditure framework. There's been some discussions, about Eskom absorbing it on its balance sheet, and obviously that would require additional guarantees or some other support from the fiscus in all probability. So our view is that it's not affordable at present. I don't think I can go further than that and give categorical commitments of beyond that. We have not, but yeah, we don't foresee it being affordable over the current MTA. Maybe, Chair, with your permission, I could go to the, I'm just checking if there's anything I've missed. I don't think so. As I say, the revenue and the sales questions, I'll come back
okay,
to.
Okay, so we're done, right? Can we move on? Oh, sorry.
Thank you. Chair, in relation to the adjustment appropriation of 10 billion, I'm going to concentrate myself only on the 3 billion allocated to SAA. I don't want us to wait up until SAA come here and tell us how they've spent it. I want us to have a process where before we go into that meeting, we get some sort of assurance from National Treasury that they've checked that indeed, as it stands, the expenditure patterns relate only to that. Because as we said, Section 16 was invoked to allocate this specific one. It's not just any other adjustment appropriation that was allocated to it. So we shouldn't wait up until that moment where a normal appearance will come. And I'm not saying I do not believe that we'll be given the correct information. I just want assurance that we there's compliance. And put our eyes on the ball in relation to this point. So, Mike, I don't know. In between, we did a something. I have very few with many meetings. It might not necessarily be anything, but, you know, a pager that says, as it stands here, and then we move on with it.
We can't slot any more meetings in. But we can certainly, I think you're right. I hadn't thought about it, but she's absolutely right. Can I also remind members that we all have the same opportunity to ask written questions. It's impossible in a three-hour sitting to address all the issues. The challenge we have in the ANC Newt Whip is for 3 years I've been trying to get an ANC researcher, but the committee researchers and content advisors can help in that regard because they serve the committee as a whole. Tandy, we desperately need an interview. I wish you well. I tried for 3 years as well. Because you see what happens, then the discussion is very lopsided because the DA with their two researchers and with the team they have here who are able to ask the questions, and that does influence the course of the meeting. But the rules are the rules, Tandy. So what I'm saying in short is, there are things that the committee researchers, I know you're very burdened. Having listened to what Ms. Tobias Tokolo has said, can Zakele and Antonia help in that regard? Let's focus on the issues we have right now, but after next week, Thursday, can you try to help in that regard and send out a proposal to the committee on how to manage that meeting? Secondly, Tandy and others, we need to remind ourselves that the Appropriations Committee deals with the appropriation side. I've done everything. We are asking Frank to go and speak to them and so on. I can't do more. I can't prescribe. I've done everything. I've given it. I've spoken to the chair 3 times now, and yesterday again fleetingly. So we've done our bit. But I think you're right, Tandy, we'll do that. Mr. Mayor?
Thank you, Chair. I know that you want to move on to the second section. Just Before we move on, I just want to point out that we still really have no real clear idea about the central mystery surrounding MTBPS 2017, and that is the absence of decisions on fiscal consolidation.
Fine, okay, so fine. Tandy, you want to reply?
I just want to make a proposal.
Yeah.
And I accept that Michael and the National Treasury are one cog in the decision-making wheel. So, I mean, I would suggest that perhaps if we could, before Tuesday, we try to interact either with the Minister or Deputy Minister that could give us a perspective on decision-making at Cabinet level. So that's a proposal. Secondly, I just want the assurance from National Treasury that they've received my questions and that as part of their follow-ups, I will receive replies before the deadline that the committee agrees to. The last question is just on the whole question of public sector debt, which is increasingly fading, shall we say, from the budget review books. I mean, do you think, given the trajectory, that if we allow consolidated debt or general government debt to push out to 60% of GDP in the outer year, would public sector debt then exceed 100% of GDP?
Tandy, you want to say something?
No, Chair. Basically, in literal terms, when David suggests that you should meet the minister before Tuesday, it's actually suggesting that we either meet him on Saturday or Sunday on Monday. Now, the last time I checked, is this man married or what? Does he have children? You see, the last time I checked, Monday it's party day, so we're not here at work. So we will not get any minister or deputy minister to come here. Two, it's Friday. I don't know whether Tebogo and Alan will be able to secure a venue for a meeting to meet any of those two on Monday. I will not mind, because I would want to engage with what David wants to engage in relation to what he believes should have been done. Because all I know is that he holds a different view in how National Treasury proceeded with fiscal consolidation. It's fine. David is going to go into the House on Tuesday. He can say anything that he needs to say, and people will respond to that. But to want to suggest a proposal that's impractical, I'll see it, Chair. I don't mind any meeting. But I know any of my colleagues won't be able to make it on Sunday. I don't go to church here in Cape Town, you know. I'm now revealing the things I do. When I'm here, I hope my priest is not watching. I don't go to church when I'm here. So I don't know what is David suggesting. Zilch, nothing. It's not possible. Tuesday, he'll have an opportunity. Wednesday, we're in the chamber. He can say all these things. We already know what David is going to say. Please, Chair, sometimes listen to me when I predict what this guy is going to say.
The second issue that Mr. Mania raises, the answers to the questions that you have to do, right? On the issue of a meeting, obviously on Mondays, if you have to meet, you have to seek special exemption from the House Chair's constituency day. We can't meet. It's what I would say is Mr. Melodramatic Mania. He knows it's not feasible. He's just doing it, and you falling bait for him. Tandy, can I once again raise this issue? Everything we do in Parliament is political. We are politicians. Any opposition member anywhere in the world would use information from budgets and so on. Yeah, then take him on politically, but don't say don't be political. We are political. We are political beings. We elected in an election. We are political representatives. So you can predict what he's going to do. None of us doesn't anticipate. I deal with Mr. Mania outside the meeting. You don't. Many, many times. I do as little of it as possible. So I can tell you, I understand his mind probably better than you do, but nevertheless, the point is he has a right to raise these questions. Show me in the rules what we are doing as chairs. The co-chair can rule me out. He has a right to ask those questions. So you'll give the replies. The first one is undoable. The remaining questions you should answer, Michael, to the extent you can.
I will try and... The written questions, we've asked our person to go and check if we've received them.
Please, right?
Yeah, we'll do our best. We will comply.
Sorry, we have comply. To.
Yeah,
because we
comply.
Have to vote on
so,
this thing.
So, but let me... I want to have another go at asking Mr. Mania's or responding to Mr. Mania's assertion that there are no decisions on the one hand. But before that,
so the minister's covered all.
We haven't received, according to the office, the questions from Mr. Mania. So maybe the committee secretary can sort out.
We'll sort it out.
But before that, I wanted to address the public debt issue that Mr. Mania is raising. I wouldn't agree at all that public debt is fading from consideration in the budget documents. Far from it. There's actually, we in the last couple of budget reviews introduced a whole new chapter called the financial position of public sector institutions, where we give great detail that was never given before on the borrowing programs and the level of debt of state-owned companies, social security funds, the GPF and the PIC. So there's a wealth of information there. All I'm saying is that when we focus on the MTBPS, since February, there's not a significant update to that information. There will be another significant update to that information in the next budget review. But it is certainly of great concern to us, and when we think about debt metrics, we look increasingly at the full picture, including the state-owned companies. As you would have seen in the MTBPS, we have a fiscal risk statement, which also is very much concerned about the management of the debt of state-owned companies. With respect to Honourable Tobias and the assurance of how all the money given to SAA be used, all I can say is that we are the shareholder representative, and we will, and I can assure that National Treasury is very concerned about the situation in SAA and is following the resources there very closely, and we will continue to do so. But that's as far as I could go now. If I may, then, with your permission, Chair, start going into the presentation. Yeah. So I must say,
matter, colleagues, before Michael, there was colleagues, you received yesterday, as required, a one-pager or one-and-a-half-pager from the PBO on alternatives of fiscal consolidation, right? They delivered. It's in your email boxes. Then Michael will be responding to that. I sent you a copy as well.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, and then you'll get a chance to reply, right? Siraj and your team. I see Gloria's also here. Can we welcome Matthew and his comrade from COSATU?
So let me just say by way of introduction that, as you are aware, I was not here, but from the excellent reports that I received on a daily basis from Ms. Makwira Miti, who was representing us here, I've tried to focus on, and having gone through all of the presentations that were made, I've tried to focus on the key issues that I thought deserved response, which might not be, we may not share the same opinion, but this is what I thought. The first was the contention made. I did see the additional note from the PBO that you sent through, but really I was responding here to the contentions made in the presentation about fiscal consolidation. And let me say at the outset that it's certainly welcome to have this kind of a debate about fiscal consolidation, austerity, stimulus measures. I don't think that is something, you know, my view is that there are no right answers to any of these questions. There's only a balance of probabilities, and always in economic policy making, I think earlier on somebody made the point that, I think it was Honourable Mania, that no decisions were made, he was saying. And I wanted to respond to him that in fiscal policy and in macroeconomic policy, there's no such thing as no decision. Because even if you make no decision, that is a decision. And usually when discussing these issues of what is going to be the impact on the economy, you never have perfect information. Even in hindsight, looking back in history, it's hard for analysts and economists and theorists to disentangle what were the various effects and causal relations in the economy that led to certain outcomes. And I'll come back to that when I speak about revenue. So we certainly welcome the debate, and it's very refreshing for us to have a response from Parliament as an institution that does challenge us on those issues. So just to say that, and this is a kind of preliminary response, that government has repeatedly raised this dilemma of economic growth and fiscal consolidation over the last few years. In fact, every single budget document of the last 3 years has said we face this dilemma of if we consolidate, we are aware that it can have a negative impact on the economy. On the other hand, if we don't consolidate, there are also negative consequences which can rebound on the economy. And so we have raised this consistently as a dilemma to which there isn't a very clear answer, except what we have said is measures that boost the rate of economic growth will relieve us of this dilemma. We are certainly prepared to acknowledge, and I think we've done in the past, that fiscal consolidation has been a headwind in respect of economic growth in recent years. So the fact that government consumption, government employment, government spending in general has not grown at the rates it was growing several years ago certainly would have dampened the rate of economic growth. However, it is our view that there are other factors, both domestic and international, structural and cyclical, in the domestic economy that have played a far stronger role in the secular deceleration of growth in the last decade. So essentially, since 2011, economic growth has decelerated year after year after year. And there are a number of factors behind that. We're prepared to acknowledge fiscal, you know, at some point fiscal consolidation played a role, but it's not the main factor in the story in our view. Secondly, it's highly doubtful that fiscal stimulus, had we enacted fiscal stimulus, we would have fundamentally changed the direction that I've just described. Indeed, it's arguably immediately after the global crisis, we had substantial fiscal stimulus and we sustained that fiscal stimulus for a number of years, but growth began to decelerate nevertheless. And it's not something that you can sustain forever in the face of falling income. And thirdly, had we not announced consolidation measures over the last 5 years, had we just left the budget to slip, it is quite likely that there would have been an adverse market response which would have also had an effect on economic growth through monetary channels. So you would have seen higher interest rates, capital outflows, and these kind of things. So that's kind of the past. Going forward, it's unlikely that South Africa can consolidate itself into a sustainable fiscal position. And what I mean by that is that without measures that enhance the rate of economic growth, the challenge we face now is so large that simply fiscal consolidation on its own is unlikely to solve the problem. We need, the only way we can really go forward is to grow. So we say there, as pointed out in the MTBPS, unless decisive action is taken to chart a new course, and that's a course of economic growth, the country could remain caught in a cycle of weak growth, mounting government debt, shrinking budgets, and rising unemployment. The only sure way forward is to grow ourselves out of the debt trap, to consolidate the fiscus through growth. So our modeling indicates, and it relates a little bit to the 40 billion figure that was mentioned before, that if we were to achieve and sustain a 3% rate of economic growth, we would stabilize the debt to GDP ratio below 60% of GDP. Even in the absence of further fiscal consolidation measures, simply by raising the growth rate from where it is now. And remember, in the outer year of our forecast, the growth rate we forecast is about 2.5. So if we just did a bit more effort to grow the economy, a lot of the fiscal challenge that we face today would be alleviated, and it would relieve us. But on the other hand, if the economy doesn't begin to grow, if the economy doesn't begin to grow, more emphasis, we will be forced to place more emphasis on fiscal consolidation, because it would mean a permanent decline in the country's income. And you can't fight a permanent decline in your income by borrowing in the short term. You have to then begin to cut your cloth, or cut your suit according to your cloth. So on the one hand, if we raise economic growth, we can stabilize the debt-to-GDP ratio. On the other hand, to argue that we must raise the economic growth rate in order to sustain the debt-to-GDP ratio by borrowing, that I don't think you can sustain that. That you should increase borrowing so much that you will stimulate the economy, it will grow, and reduce your debt-to-GDP ratio. I think there are some economists that do argue that in certain circumstances, and I think that's the other thing I want to convey, is that our circumstances differ greatly from many other economies, the US, Japan, OECD countries, where sometimes these types of arguments tend to be drawn from. So it may be well be the case that that argument does work in another circumstance, in another economy. But our view is that in this circumstance, in this economy, and we've done some modeling around this, trying to lift ourselves up by our bootstraps by borrowing in order to stabilize debt would not achieve even its own objective and would leave us out much worse. So in conclusion, there is this Presidential Fiscal Committee, and its mandate is to stabilize, to look at measures to stabilize the debt-to-GDP ratio over the medium term through measures to narrow the deficit, which is fiscal consolidation, but also to stimulate economic growth. And maybe there are other places where we can look at even stimulating aggregate demand that don't require government borrowing. And build investor confidence, and those are three are key. Let me then come to Mr. Mania's assertion that about the absence of decisions. I think that, to be fair, the size of the challenge we faced in this MTBPS was unprecedented. Over the last 5 years, we have had slippages on our deficit targets in the order of 0.1, 0.2% of GDP, maybe 0.3%. So we start the budget in February, maybe we come to the MTBPS, we see growth has disappointed, we have a slippage. The deficit has widened from our target of 3% to 3.2%. And we responded by saying, well, we can introduce some moderate revenue-raising measures and some moderate expenditure reduction measures that will take the deficit from that new slip target to somewhere closer to the original target. And as Treasury, we would be able, we were confident that those measures would gain traction quite easily. Now, there are two things different now. The first is that because we've been doing those measures over and over again, the low-hanging fruit in terms of fiscal consolidation has been picked. So, and we're beginning to observe that repeated rounds of expenditure reductions is having a negative impact on the state of the public finances. And repeated rounds of revenue-raising measures have begun to yield a diminishing return. So it leaves us in a so that's the first point. The second point is that the size of the gap was in a completely different league from what we've seen in the previous rounds. It's a 1.1% slippage on the deficit or thereabouts. So it means that for those two reasons, the decisions that are required are far beyond the type of adjustments. They're much more difficult decisions than the type of adjustments that we were that we could envisage in previous rounds. So even all other things remaining equal, and by that I'm talking about politics in the main, whatever your view of the political situation, objectively, the challenge we had in this MTBPS is certainly the greatest we've had since the 2009 crisis,
and probably even greater. And therefore, we have not said, let's not take decisions. We've said the decisions we need to take are so momentous, let us think about them a bit more. But in the meantime, report to the country the true picture and the consequences of a framework in which, if we don't take those decisions, this is where we'll be. So I think that was the approach we took. It maybe others would have taken a different approach, but there you have it. So, secondly, this is just for, I think in the written responses it says the members requested an update to the actions to boost confidence, and it just says there it's in Annex A, but I didn't see Annex A attached, so this is just for your information. I won't go through it, but you can ask me questions about it later. Factors behind revenue under collection. And I think this is very important to understand. I would like to go through it in a little bit of detail. The graph there is really the critical graph that we need to understand. It shows the growth rate of nominal GDP, which is the black line, and the growth rate of revenue. And you can see starting around 2004, 2005, nominal GDP was growing around 10%. And when I talk about nominal GDP, that's different from when we talk real. Usually we talk about the real GDP growth rate, which is the important thing. But nominal includes the increase in prices, right, which is it's just the rand value of GDP. So it was growing around between 10 and 15%, but revenue was growing in excess of 15% per annum in nominal terms. Now, what was the reason for that? Was it the extraordinary improvements in tax administration that were taking place at that time, e-filing, improving the position of SARS, etc.? Was it, because by the way, we were actually lowering tax rates over that period. Was it a response to those tax policy measures, where as we lowered the corporate income tax but broadened its base, policy was resulting in new revenues coming in? Or was it simply a function of the commodity boom? In other words, extraneous or economic circumstances that have nothing to do with policy or administration feeding into higher profits in the mining sector, feeding into the finance sector, leading to higher revenue collection? Now, the truthful answer is that it was probably all three, but we're not sure how to disentangle those factors. Now, what you have over the last 5 years is a revenue buoyancy that remained, then in 2009 you have the crisis, revenue collapses, but then since from 2010 until 2016, revenue grows faster than the economy. Why? Was it, and the same factors we can look at, why? All along, and if you look back in our documents, we raised this as a risk, that we said, it's odd. There's not a very clear explanation as to why revenue is continuing to grow faster than the economy. But we're a bit worried about it, because if it is temporary, because there were two views. The one would say there's a permanent change in the relationship between the economy and revenue growth, which will lead revenue to grow faster than the economy permanently. Might be change in the structure of the economy towards services, for instance. On the other hand, others were of the view that this is a temporary boost as a result of the fact that commodity prices remained elevated and such things. But it was hard to know, so we reflected it as a risk that if this comes to an end, we are going to face significant trouble. So what you see in 2016 is the first time since the global crisis, which was an outlier, in fact, the first time revenue now is growing at the same rate as the economy. So in addition to the economy continuing to decelerate, revenue has also fallen. And let me also point out that the economic deceleration this time round had two components. We had substantial downward revisions to real GDP growth, from 1.3 in the budget to 0.7 now. But we also had substantial downward revisions to inflation. So from an inflation forecast in excess of 6% to one more of 5.5%, right? And from a revenue point of view, inflation is equally, at least in the short term, inflation feeds into revenue growth just as much as real GDP. So what explains the revenue weakness? Growth in key sectors have slowed. So we never before the last recession saw the kind of contraction in the services sector and the financial sector, a major source of revenue, that was unprecedented and entirely unexpected. We saw low bonus payments, moderate wage settlements, job losses, and slower employment growth. A lot, because so much of our revenue is sourced from the top 10% of the population, really the trends in the wage bill at that of that top 10% are critical in determining our revenue collection. So, I usually make this example. If a mine retrenches 100 rock drill operators, rock drillers, and employs one engineer to run a machine, from a revenue point of view, that may well be positive, from a government revenue point of view, because you have got, and I'm just talking mechanically on the personal income tax base. No. I'm not saying this is a good thing. I'm just explaining that. Okay, I'll come back and conclude. But
don't be intimidated by her.
Yeah. No, I'm more intimidated by Matthew over there. But the rock drill operators. The rock drill operators fall below the threshold or are just above the threshold for personal income tax. So the fact that they've become unemployed has no direct impact on personal income tax collections. It may have impact on other taxes down the road, but not on personal. Whereas the employment of the engineer and the fact that the engineer has now got bonuses and whatever, that's a tax base now that we have. So in the short term, over that period, what may have been happening is, I don't know whether this is kosher for me to say this, but I usually say if Woolworths is booming, then the tax base is booming. If consumption at the upper end of the income distribution, because even if you look at VAT, we usually think of VAT as being regressive, which you might argue it is. But 60 to 80% of VAT, the raw money we collect, comes from the top 10% of the income distribution. Because those are the people that spend the big money in the economy that attracts VAT. The people at the low end, VAT might be a higher share of their income. But in terms of the total receipts they generate, it's much smaller. So it may be that the slowing economic growth has finally caught up with the elite, in which case the revenue collection may have fallen. Thirdly, more obviously, persistently weak growth and commodity price volatility in the mining sector. The mining sector is critical both as a direct source of revenue but also through its linkages into the rest of the economy. Fourthly, we had a very large contraction in imports last year. Now, again, it's important to understand this. From an economic point of view, and it's a similar story as to the one about the low-income workers, from an economic point of view, we all want exports, and we don't want imports, although that's putting it a bit crudely. But broadly speaking, we would all support that. Let's have more exports and fewer imports. But from a tax policy or revenue collection point of view, we don't tax exports, but we do tax imports. So if imports collapse, it is a net positive for economic growth, but a net negative for revenue. So a lot of that fall in buoyancy is because the fall in imports, which contracted in real terms by about 3% last year, was far greater than the fall in economic growth. So your customs duties and your VAT on imports in particular, and that explains much of the fall on VAT. And lastly, the stabilization of the rand. Over the last 3 to 5 years, you've seen depreciation of the rand year after year, which
came to an end this year. Depreciation of the rand buoys profits in the traded sectors of the economy. So the fact that the rand has been stable and even appreciated well up until recently may also have had an effect. So there are solid economic grounds for explaining this behavior. However, there are other factors. As I said, there are many factors. It's a complex thing. Behavioral responses to tax increases. There's a concept of dubious empirical validity, but which is worth thinking about, called the Laffer curve, that you get to a point where you raise the tax rate, but the amount you actually collect on that tax falls because you raise, a simple example would be you raise tax on cigarettes to such an extent that people stop smoking, and then the amount you collect actually begins to fall, which probably is good from a health point of view, but a similar behavioral response to your tax changes can happen. And we've been raising taxes quite significantly over the last 5 years. So there's a question. Is there space for us to, if we continue raising taxes, will we get the amount we would like? And I'll come back to Honorable Lee's question about PI, because we kind of say, what we're arguing there is more that tax increases are generating additional revenue, which is a different question from saying the additional revenue that they're generating may be diminishing. There's a diminishing marginal return from the tax increases is true, but they are still we're not at the top of the Laffer curve, but there may be an impact. Secondly, compliance concerns and weakening tax morality. This is something SARS is raising quite strongly, that in their view, they're experiencing increasingly aggressive tax planning, is the polite way to put it. And obviously that relates, and I don't think one should relate that only to SARS. The expenditure side of the budget and the overall situation of the country and sense of are the public finances being deployed in the public interest are as important as whatever people's perceptions of SARS as a particular institution is. But lastly, and obviously, administrative challenges in SARS. Over the last 2 years or so, it's an objective fact that there have been substantial changes at the senior management level. And in anyone who's been in an organization where there are substantial changes at the senior management level knows that that can disrupt operations. So there, and added to that has been the tax ombuds report. So there are concerns about the impact of administrative weaknesses on revenue collection. Personally, my own view is that the administrative challenge is most likely to be a long-term issue. It doesn't really make sense to me that, or let me put it the other way, the 50 billion rand shortfall is much more about the economic trends I've described than any of the other factors here. So, and of course, having said all of that, there's a profound risk that we don't know what the future trajectory will be. So, honourable members have raised the question of corporate income tax and the effective tax rates versus the statutory tax rates. And I just wanted to use this graph to generate some further discussion on this. It shows corporate tax collection as a share of GDP. So, of the total national income, how much is collected in corporate tax? And you'll see that South Africa, those are all OECD countries, which tend to have much higher tax rates than anyone else. South Africa has, it's only Chile that has a higher corporate tax collection than South Africa. And there's a lot of debate to be had about the effective rate versus the statutory rate. Recently, the World Bank did some reports which showed that the marginal effective rate is very low in certain sectors and in some cases negative. Now, it's important to understand what that is. What it is if you invest 1 rand in capital stock in that sector and you get a return on that investment. What is the rate of, what's the difference between the pre-tax and the after-tax return? And if you say the marginal effective tax rate is zero, it means the difference between the pre-tax and the after-tax return on that investment is zero. Right? So that, you may say, is a problem, and people should be taxed on their investment, and their investment returns may very well be the case. But remember that it's there for a reason, which is that we're trying to encourage people to invest so that the economy grows. So there's a lot of debate to be had about this. It's certainly, again, going back to Honorable Lisa's question, we are certainly wary of raising the statutory rate of corporate income tax. Many countries around the world are reducing their corporate income taxes, and the larger the gap between our tax and other people's taxes, particularly in countries that provide foreign direct investment to us, like the Netherlands and the UK and the US, the larger the gap, the more the incentive to engage in base erosion and profit sharing. So there's a bit of a trade-off there, that if you keep raising your tax while others are lowering it, but even now you're like encouraging people to either not invest or to find ways of bypassing the system, which certainly needs to be strengthened, countering that. But so on the illicit capital flows, which was also raised, estimates of illegal capital flows are generally unreliable. It's important to point that out. These are illegal flows that nobody really knows. Tax and financial crimes are complex and sophisticated crimes committed by highly skilled and well-connected people with extensive resources, capacity to investigate and prosecute people who are engaged in illicit financial activities is critical. Dedicated and highly trained personnel are needed to focus on these complex and sophisticated crimes. To increase tax yield from capital flows, we need to strengthen the transfer pricing audit capacity within SARS, as well as its capacity to implement the transfer pricing country-by-country reporting and audit reportable arrangements. Other law enforcement and regulatory agencies have a critical role to play, anti-money laundering agencies, the Reserve Bank, policing and prosecution authorities. No matter how well drafted our laws may be, without stronger capacity to enforce such laws, we will not win the battle against illicit capital flow. So, I mean, this is really about tax administration and law enforcement. That's rather than tax policy. There are certainly policy matters involved here, but the biggest marginal return is going to come from there. Moving on to some of the statements made in the COSATU submission. And I think, again, I'm providing these things because I think it's important for us to understand. So COSATU said in its statement that the state is actively reducing the number of jobs available in the public sector. Now, it is true that the jobs in the public sector have declined marginally, but it is more correct to say that the growth rate of public sector employment has stalled. So it's not that we're reducing the number of public servants, but as you see in that first graph on the left, from 2006, and if I went back further, it would be more pronounced, there was rapid growth in the employment of, and those are full-time equivalents. There was rapid growth until we reached a peak in around 2012, and since then there's been a moderate reduction of about 20 to 30,000 total full-time equivalents. We then, on the table on the right, look at some of the large occupation-specific dispensations and provide data on their employment growth and their remuneration growth. And you can see teachers really underscore what I'm saying, that there have been no growth in teachers by full-time equivalent since 2009 over that period, which is not what you would want, because certainly the school population has grown. So it implies a falling learner-educator ratio. But in terms of the employment opportunities there, and surely the pool of people looking for employment has also grown, but it's a zero growth. Nurses have grown by about 3% each year on average over the last 5 or 6 years. So the nursing profession does continue to grow. Police and corrections have grown much slower, but there is a concern there that there's been increasing growth in not in the police service has grown faster than this, but the police officers have grown at a slower rate. In other words, administrative office personnel have grown. And I don't think it would be right to say that necessarily that is wrong. It may be the case that an administrator, that there were insufficient administrators in the police force earlier, and that detectives were unable to do their detective work because they had so much administration to do. It's not necessarily a bad or a good thing. You have to go under the bonnet and see more what's going on. But what is also notable there is that those professions over the last 5 years have seen remuneration growth on average far in excess of inflation every year. And in a context of fiscal constraints, we face a trade-off between the growth of the headcounts and the growth of the remuneration. And it's arithmetic. It's not ideology. Maybe there's other, and as Kusatu does say in their presentation, which certainly we would welcome, we need to have a proper discussion about how we take this forward in the national interest, but we do need to be on the same page as far as the facts are concerned. Secondly, Kusatu points to the need to reduce the out-of-control salaries of state-owned companies, CEOs and executives, political office bearers, including DGs. And I think they may well have a point in respect of state-owned companies, CEOs and executives. High salaries and bonuses in publicly funded entities are of great concern and are being reviewed, and that's certainly something we should take action on. Nevertheless, within the public service proper, the challenge we have, often people talk about the apartheid wage gap must be closed. We actually have the opposite challenge in the public sector now. There, that table shows you the average annual growth in real terms of average remuneration in different salary levels. Now, I mean, I'm not revealing any secret by saying I am level 15 because I'm a DDG. Ian here is level 14 because he's a chief director. That's how it works. Most teachers are around level 7 to 9. Now, what is notable there is that the lower, in general, it's not an exact pattern, but in general, the lower levels have seen much faster increase in income than the higher levels. And indeed, DGs are being unfairly targeted by Kusatu, I think, because they've seen a negative, they've seen a 1%, and that's an average annual drop in their salary. This is also illustrated in the graph on the top right, which shows the red line is the average cost of living adjustments of level 1 to 12. Those are unionized workers represented in bargaining chambers. The key thing there is the difference between that and the dotted line, which is CPI. And you can see that over the last 10 years or so, and even longer, or it's 10 years, cost of living adjustments have been far in excess of CPI. But for management, the average for the level 13 to 16, their salaries have stuck very closely to CPI, their salary adjustments. So what we are seeing is then illustrated in the bottom graph, which compares the distribution of income of taxpayers versus the distribution of income of public servants. And you can see that at every point along that distribution, public servants are more equitably remunerated than taxpayers. And it's summarized in that statistic, in that bullet point, that the highest 1% of public servants receive 23 times the salary of the lowest 1% of public servants. So the gap, so you could say a DG.
Can you explain it, please?
So a DG, let's say, receives about 23 times the salary of a low paid, maybe a cleaner in a hospital, a level one employee. Right? But in the private sector, the gap between the top, or the difference between the top 1% of earning wage earners across all taxpayers is 633 times the bottom 1%. So in a highly inequitable society, the public sector is actually massively offsetting this inequality because we have a great deal of equity in our wage setting. And it becomes a problem, actually. It can go too far, where there is insufficient difference between the salaries at the top and the salaries at the bottom can have negative consequences for management. The Fiscal Cliff Study Group argues that a combination of mandated expenditures on debt service costs and compensation of employees is crowding out other expenditures and eroding the effectiveness of the public finances. That is certainly true. And we demonstrate, if you look at some of the figures we presented, 10 years ago, the Defense Force, about 40% of their budget went on salaries. Today, it's 60%. And that can't be an effective Defense Force. Again, it's important that we're not blaming workers for that. It's a combination of compensation budgets continuing to increase on the one hand and fiscal consolidation requirements limiting the overall budget on the other hand. And this goes back to the question of the decisions that need to be taken. That if we simply continue to cut budgets without making the decisions that need to be made, we're going to have increasingly dysfunctional public services where there are public servants paid salaries, but there are not the complementary inputs that they require to do their jobs. It's really a hallmark of when you get into a fiscal crisis is where your debt service costs, which we're saying is now going towards 15% of revenue, and your compensation budgets begin to crowd out everything else, and that all you become is a government that pays salaries and pays back its debts, and you don't have much else room to maneuver. So we certainly agree with that sentiment. Where we would disagree with them is the idea of a cliff, that this is a sudden falling over the edge. It's rather a trend that we need to monitor and be concerned about. They suggest that the purchase of only vehicles manufactured in South Africa for government's vehicle fleet, it's a good idea, needs to be taken forward in the ministerial handbook. And I drive an imported car, if you would like to know. Yeah, I'm sorry. But it doesn't belong to government. It belongs to me.
Okay, we're running out of time, Michael.
Okay.
We can round up.
Revenue sharing agreement with SACU is certainly... No, that's fine. I'm not a public representative. I can drive whatever I want.
We move on. We're running out of time. 12:30 is a cut-off point. Colleagues, I want to remind you the procedure until now, but I see everything up for review suddenly, is we have to have COSATU to reply, PBO to reply, and then we have discussion, right? So
okay.
Please get me on.
So the SACU, in the MTBPS, there's a table at the back on page 68 if anyone has it, but it shows their customs and excise duties and SACU transfers. So this year we received 88 billion in customs and excise, or we're expecting to. Of that, 56 billion is going to be transferred to SACU. The SACU formula is not working for South Africa, and it's not working for our SACU partners, and it is under review, and it should be reviewed. We have revised down, I will show you the numbers just after. We have revised down the SACU transfers by 34 billion over the next 2 years. That is good for us. In fact, if that had not happened, that would have been an additional 34 billion revenue shortfall on our books. So this actually massively offsets the shortfall on the deficit. It's not something that we decide. It's purely driven by a formula that is set out in the treaty. So it's kind of an automatic thing. But from the point of view of Swaziland and Lesotho in particular, this is going to be a massive fiscal shock. And it's not a fiscal shock that we can walk away from, because however it is addressed, it will have consequences that South Africa at some point will have to face. So it really is becoming urgent, more urgent, that we do look at this problem. We broadly agree with the sentiments expressed in the UNICEF presentation, and I think for sake of time I'll just proceed. The question was asked about the members of the Presidential Fiscal Committee. I think the Minister did mention that later, but there's the names for you.
It's up to you. You've got up to 7 minutes, please. And then we throw it open to questions up to PBL. It behoves me to say this, colleagues. No matter whether we agree or disagree with Michael Sacks' input here and there, it's a remarkably lucid, clear input. And for people as simple as I am, I really think it's sparkling clarity, actually. You can disagree with it. This is the way officials should speak to us. Simple, clear language. We can disagree, but it's wonderful, the input. Can I take this opportunity of complimenting you and your team? It's wonderful the way you speak and the clarity with which you present points. I hope the majority agree. Thank you for that. Sorry? No, I would like to compliment people where they deserve it. I don't understand. Look, as a chair, okay, I speak on my own behalf. I don't know whether others agree. I have a right to say it. It's a wonderful input. Whether I agree or disagree is another issue on the content, but it's very well put. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I think also just to add to your sentiments, Chair, I think we'd also want to appreciate officials like Michael and others who have a strong sense of integrity and are holding a fort in a very trying time for government and the nation, etc. We hope the Nahau membership is up to date. Then we can be more sympathetic to the DDG request for salary increases and so on. Chair, yeah, I think we also wanted to say, look, we appreciate the honesty of government in the budget statement. And much of the areas that we do agree with, I think for us, the kind of maybe 4 points of frustration was that there's a recognition of crises across state-owned enterprises, beyond even SAA, and beyond changing the boards of SAA, ESCOM, and I think, is it Enel or SABC, we don't really get a sense of what's the kind of drastic actions by the state to address, to turn around the crises. Because we've been going through bailouts for SAA for year after year. It's a good start to change the chair, for example, to satisfy Honourable Lees, but we need a much deeper intervention. So I think that is our one frustration, Chair. And I think also, Chair, what are the consequences for those who cause the crisis in the state-owned enterprises? Because it seems to be okay that we can collapse SAA. You can have daily reports of ESCOM basically borrowing R1 billion to some company. It's amazing kind of stuff. I never even, banks hammer us for our small little debit orders and what. But ESCOM was such a progressive, patriotic business that just hands off money like Smarties, but okay. So I think, yeah, that is one frustration, Chair. I think also that, Chair, I mean, look, corruption is an everyday language. We know Michael and the colleagues don't have a magic wand, but really the hope from government was to see kind of meaningful action to reduce corruption. It seems to be that there's no consequences. You have a report of a Premier's residence in KZN, 32 million rand. We don't even see a denial from government. So really kind of it's difficult for taxpayers or workers to be sympathetic to government's fiscal pressures, but there seems to be kind of no effort to stem the bleeding, and especially around ESCOM, Chair. The only intervention we've seen on ESCOM is by Parliament itself, which is very good to try to turn things around. I think the last two issues, Chair, is that we met with the Minister of Finance, Komri Gigaba, on Friday at NEDLAC. And again, it was a good, constructive, honest, robust discussion. And he made mention there that in the February speech that there'll be a stimulus plan presented to try to push the economy and so on. There wasn't much detail beyond that. I'm not sure if Michael's able to kind of give a broad kind of thrust, objectives, content or something like that. What would be the engagement processes with business, with labor, to bring everybody on board? Then I think lastly, Chair, look, we must give credit to government on the public service wage bill. As Michael's saying, it's correct that they've managed to largely reduce their part of wage gap in significant ways as compared to your shop rights. We have a CEO making 100 million rand in a year and a cashier making 60,000 in a temporary position. But Chair, I think our point was that we can say, fine, the DGs, for example, have had a below inflation increase. But still, if you're earning 1.8 million or 2 million, whatever it is, compared to a nurse earning 280,000. It's a huge gap. And I think it's difficult for nurses and them to keep up with inflation because inflation at your food, your electricity, your petrol, transport, school is much higher. They have less space to manage it, whereas a DG has got much more space to cut the belt. I think that is the point we're making, Chair, especially on the SOEs. I'm not sure if my colleague Tengo wants to add that from my side, Chair. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I've got one more addition. I think, like everyone who has welcomed the presentation, I must also do the same and also invite Treasury to table some of the data that they've been presenting here in Parliament to the Bargaining Council for further engagements and engage unions on some of the issues. The second issue I wanted to raise is in relation to the honesty of the presentation, precisely because you see an impression in the public is being created that the growth of the wage bill generally is precisely because of labor movement and all those things. But the reality is, if you look at the critical areas where we need to build capacity so that we can effectively build an effective state, because the issue is about prioritizing issues around state building, state formation. Now, if we prioritize those, it also means that critical areas like education, for example, the teacher to student ratio, if you look at, for example, around the nurse to patient ratio in our public hospitals, for example, if you look at the key areas around home affairs, the worker there to clients or those who are looking for service. So these are the issues that we think, in terms of our prioritization around our spending, whether we need to have a debate whether we spend on DDGs or our expenditure is about making sure that we strengthen local government, we strengthen critical service areas, which actually may be able to improve the conditions of our people and all those. So we welcome the discussion and are hoping that Treasury this time would also be engaging in the together with unions in the bargaining council to deal with these issues and discuss issues around what should be prioritized and all those things. Thank you, Chair.
Take it, there aren't any other of those who made submissions on Wednesday here, right? Okay, over to PBO.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. I think I would just start as well just congratulating Michael for his good work, and also as one of the people at Treasury who is open to talking about macroeconomics and different approaches. And I think that's really important as we take this kind of discussion forward. And I'm happy that also that within the joint committees that you want to take this kind of discussion forward. Now, to start off with, I mean, the point about fiscal consolidation and the headwinds and there being stronger other factors, I mean, that's undoubtable. I mean, the whole point of my inputs and also the one pager plus appendix I gave to the committees is to say that we need to understand that this has happened in the aftermath of a global financial crisis, a hugely traumatic, hurtful, destructive event where a country like South Africa that hadn't even, we had a huge housing bubble, etc., we lost some estimates 2.5 million jobs. Right, we saw our unemployment rate go to 27.7%. So nobody's disputing that. The point is, when do you start turning around? How long do you actually stimulate your economy? And what are the impacts of fiscal consolidation in the aftermath and turning to fiscal consolidation too soon? Now, I was really careful in the brief I gave you to focus only on mainstream economists. And not only mainstream economists, but Blanchard, when he wrote this, was the chief economist of the IMF. He's an MIT economist. They actually fall on the center-right and right of the spectrum in economics thinking. Larry Summers, Jason Furman, who advised
was an economic advisor to head of the Economic Advisory Council to President Obama. These are people who are trying to get government to be, and they're also writing about developing countries, I should say. And so the point that, you know, that may work in the U.S. or Japan, but it won't work here, I think we really have to be careful about as well. But they weren't telling countries, get yourself into debt problems to get out of the crisis. What they're doing is they're actually saying, we were wrong. And we underestimated the impact of the crisis. We underestimated the size of multipliers in the event of the crisis, and that much more could be achieved with fiscal consolidation. And they're saying that when you they're actually saying that many countries started moving to fiscal consolidation too soon. And what happened was that the Greek crisis and the sovereign debt crisis that scared people in Europe, but also around the world. And very quickly, the IMF and others pushed developing countries and others like ourselves. They didn't push us. They suggested to us. And I think internally, people also felt that our debt to GDP levels were getting high. but I think in the aftermath of that, in the assessment of that, starting from 2014 onwards, there's a broad agreement. One is that macroeconomic policy, thinking about fiscal policy, needs to be changed, needs to be updated, and I really worried that National Treasury may be once again behind the curve of the IMF and other thinking on this, not necessarily the left thinking or more progressive thinking, even of the IMF's thinking. And I'm saying that we need to think about that, and that basically this idea that, you know, we should stabilize debt at 60%. 60% is a number that has come from the IMF as a fairly random pick out of a hat. They basically took, in a report, the median debt to GDP levels at a certain point and decided that was what they were going to set it at. There is, as we said yesterday, myself and another presenter, that there is no magic number. And as I said yesterday, the studies show that up to 90%, you may have a negative 0.1% effect on GDP growth, and even that study has been questioned to say that you still have plus 2.2% growth. So the question is, when you're coming out of a crisis, when you've had this kind of trauma, job losses, effect on your economy, at what point do you say, I'm going to dig in now and I'm going to actually use the state? And one of the points we made as the PBO is that in the aftermath of the crisis, we still saw the state investing in capital stock and in people, and especially high-skilled people. Now, we're not saying that those people are necessarily used as well and as efficiently as they are, but it puts us in a very, there's been a process of state formation that needs to be consolidated, and one of the ways you may be able to consolidate that is by actually putting more money behind it. And the issues of how you raise that money is a question as well. I don't want to come out too strongly because it isn't the position of others to support fiscal stimulation. I'm just putting it out there, and I'm saying what we're seeing in the literature, what we're seeing from experience, what we're seeing in agreement across international agencies and thought is that you need to actually basically push this further to get yourselves out of the process. There's also, I should add, an agreement that when everybody started fiscal consolidation together, that had a negative effect on global growth as a whole. So that's also something to think about. And so we're in a situation, along with many other countries. And in my short write-up, I actually spoke about how widespread this was. I just wanted to make a point on capital flows. On illicit capital flows, sorry. I appreciate that there is now a more seriousness about addressing this, but this is something that's been a long time coming. I mean, I published a chapter with a co-author in the book in 2005, but something that was written in 2003, and we discussed this in the South African debate in the 1990s in economics. And to actually now see people saying, well, we're going to do this, is really worrisome to me. And that I think we should now take it with the seriousness it needs to be taken. And if we had taken it seriously 10 years ago, we probably wouldn't have the debt-to-GDP levels we have today. And that illicit flows is something that you know, in 10 years' time could maybe help us build that fiscal space that we may need if there's another crisis or something else, and we may not lose 2 million jobs. The other thing is that last bullet point, it may be from a very narrow technical perspective correct, right? No matter how well drafted our laws may be, without stronger capacity, we will not win the battles against illicit financial flows. I think that I agree we need to build the capacity and we need to monitor much more. And to some extent, we've actually reduced our monitoring capacity, especially in the Reserve Bank, but I won't go into that. But the point is, there are regulations that even without, and this is proven in the literature, there are certain ways in which you can regulate financial flows that limit illicit financial flows. And you're never actually going to stop all flows. It doesn't matter how many people monitored, what the laws are, etc. And to some extent, when you say we will not win the battle, you really need to say what your battle is. You need to actually say, my battle is stopping 10% of illicit financial flows for this year and maybe 15% in 10 years' time or something. But, I mean, that would make a huge difference to our deficit if we manage to do that. And then the last point...
One, please, very quickly.
Okay. I'm going outside the ambit here, but just on okay, maybe I'll just stop this. Thank you.
All right, thanks. I'm sorry about that, because you're in-house, and yeah, we've got questions from Tandy. We've got, how many people want to ask questions? Now, this is on the second set of issues, right? Response to public hearing. One, two, three, who else? Yeah, about 3 to 4 minutes, please.
So let me start with the prelude. You know, it's very difficult to discuss an important thing like fiscal policy in an hour's time, because you have to listen to different arguments from economists who will read different literatures and want to argue their point. But I'm going to be very measured, because from the point where I stand, wanting to discuss these matters and representing the organization and in the presence of many other people and wanting to look at the best models that needs to be applied, it becomes very limiting. So I take it for granted, Mike, through the chair, that at some point, a platform needs to be created where these matters can be discussed thoroughly. Because having listened to both your presentations, I still believe we need time just to engage on this, even if it's not going to necessarily change the policy formulation, because the macroeconomic policy and the fiscal policy is decided somewhere else. But to listen to people like the two of you putting across your engagement was very interesting. And let me start with the longer hanging one. You see, when you're speaking specifically to issues of consultation, some argue that you don't necessarily have to go that route. Some argue that this is the best model for now. But you know, I wanted to answer a question that somebody, I can't remember the name, and I suspect it's Floyd, he might not be here. There was a person who once argued that you need to balance economic growth with your expenditure. Now, when I listened to you, when you said we need to look at revenue measures and expenditure reduction, I have my own suspicions as to what has increased revenue when economic growth was not realized. And one of my suspicions, and I'm using this word suspicion, because I suspect that we might have collected more in taxes that might have not meshed the economic outlook in terms of the performance of that. It's a debate for another day. We will have to relook and engage on that issue. But one of the fundamental issues that I think we must take home as part of homework is how our tax policy is structured. Because there's different views as to how do you apply your tax policies to be able to collect more revenue. There's also a suspicion that the reason why we were able to collect more, it had anything to do with withholding refunds to people who are entitled to that. That's a debate for another day. But the main issue here, for you to be able to build capital stock, you first have to look at the productive sectors and its performances. I'm not going to argue policy positions in terms of how we should go about it. The main issue is, here is a mandate paper, it has been presented to us. We, as this collective, takes a posture of wanting to ensure implementation thereof. Therefore, when we converge at some point, we will not be discussing fiscal policy like others want to change it. We will say, how far have you been able to implement what is in the mandate paper? Okay. So when we look at the focus areas when we come, it will be all those things. But secondly, we need to be transparent as to how we report on the performance of the economy itself and the sectors that we believe can make a dent. Equally so, we need to engage COSATU and others in relation to what they believe that government and Comrade Smith, you see, when that slide was presented, I was happy because we were smiling. What we should be able to emphasize is those areas within, and one of the fundamental things that you raised, Mike, it's how we structure the issue of employee payments. It's an issue that we might want to make very strong recommendations. And you've given those who were able to benefit through administration and those that did not. And I looked at my colleagues who belonged to defense at some point and never had raised these issues when they were there. And he's looking at me now because, you know, he didn't do it. I was listening very carefully when he did this. You see, he's responding. Good. So I'm doing a good job. Now, I wanted us to have suggestions. You see, you gave an illustration of the salary gap between the highest paid CEO in the private sector and the lowest income earner and how they make contributions to a tax bracket. We might not necessarily hold the same view with COSATU as to who then do tax as a median taxpayer and who should you actually encourage to put there so that you can collect more. So there's a different view. And the PBO might not share the same sentiments in terms of how you approached this MTVPS in terms of the challenges that are there. Now, that's why I said I'll be measured, because some of the things is self-criticism that I cannot raise in the current conjuncture here in terms of our own challenges in terms of economic growth. So maybe we're fortunate that this happens at a time where we'll go to conference and we'll be able to raise this issue. So some of the things that will emanate from that, it's issues that you said in one line by saying economic growth must be juxtaposed to fiscal consolidation. And to me, it becomes an adequate response. And the stimulus package that people want in detail doesn't necessarily have to be the detail, but the stimulus package is informed by economic growth. It's the how you employ the productive sector to be able to. And now you raise another issue that we might want to consider. Imports creates revenue. That's an issue that we need when we're talking about the stabilization of the rent and so on. We might want. So basically I'm saying, well, I'm cherry picking on the issues that become the primary issue to discuss. But in terms of the models, the modalities, the two of you will have to resolve it over tea to say which is the best model in the current conjunction that must be taken forth. Listening to you, comrades. You have made my job even more difficult in the presence of David Mania and the rest to say this is the best. But I'm saying we shouldn't limit such debates to time frames like we have today, because in terms of the role that politicians play in terms of approving the adjustments and the budget itself, we need to be able to take informed decisions and not necessarily be limited to the time frame. So I'm saying this welcoming those presentations, but it was interesting. And let me also raise this thing, because I said it was raised by, I think, Floyd at some point. There's an argument that suggests that those who are high income earners doesn't necessarily spend and that doesn't necessarily lead to your buoyance in terms of value-added tax or any other taxation that you tax those who are. I'm not advancing the argument. I'm saying that's the perception that's there. So at some point, we need to clarify it and quantify it with information that is relative to the expenditure patterns of those high-income earners as opposed to those who are burdened at a lower level. So maybe that's one thing that we need to clarify so that we expand it and it's not there, because it remains an issue hanging. That is it true that those high-income earners actually spend? That's why when I said we need to review our tax policy, we should look at whether the model that we have applied has been of assistance in the long term, given the debate that those believe that in terms of the current performance of SARS, it has been limited to what has been presented to us then.
To remind members, we are set to finish at 12:30, but I'm pretty easy comrade chair. I have to leave at 12:30. We can continue till as late as you want. No, I'm fine with that. Okay, over to the next two members. Mkululeko, don't you want to ask anything as well? You're fine. Okay. It's very good to have you here. We don't see enough of you, and I'm very pleased you're here. So please feel free.
Thank you, Chair. Just one question and 2 points. In your slide, you provide further information about employment and remuneration of major OSD groups. But in your supplement, which I certainly sort of compliment National Treasury for, you also set out particulars about employment level of full-time equivalents in non-OSD groups. And I wonder if in your written responses you could provide a breakdown of who exactly or where would we find the 1,990 additional members of the public service who were employed between 2008-09 and 2016-17 in non-OSD posts at level 13 to 16. I'd be quite interested in the distribution of exactly who and where they are. So that's just a point which I wonder if you could pick up in your written responses. And then finally, I should thank National Treasury for assisting me to refine my question, which I think still remains the central question of NTBPS 2016. And that question is why, given the enormous challenge, in your own words, Michael, the greatest challenge since the fiscal crisis, was, again in your own words, was the decision to take no decision. That's the central question that we need answered. And it is a monumental failure of government.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one quick one. On your slide 3, and it's not just you, I mean, there have been a number of acceptances of administrative challenges at SARS, and we've had the tax ombuds report and so on. My concern is that the SARS commissioner on the 30th of October issued an internal statement to his staff. It says, what we do speaks for itself and will help to, and this is the critical thing, to dispel the misrepresentation of facts on refund payments. Now, I know you can't comment on that, but if there's a recognition in National Treasury that this might be an issue or is an issue, are you guys talking to SARS? Because as recently as 2 or 3 days ago, the SARS commissioner is saying it's a misrepresentation of facts. And so you can't comment on what he says. What I'm trying to say is that are you guys talking to each other? Are we trying to fix the problems that have been identified, or is there a total denial and you can't get the message across?
That I didn't make in response to the PBO. I think Larry Summers would be very surprised to hear himself characterized as coming from the centre-right.
Okay. Fine. I don't want to ask all the questions. I just want to deal with procedural matters as a chair. One is, comrades and colleagues, we have done this before. When somebody appears repeatedly at public hearings and says the same thing over and over again, I don't think it's right. Remember, we instructed the executive department to reply to people and so on. So when they come the next time, they say something new. So the first recommendation I've got is, Michael, I spoke to you, that all the recommendations that came from the fiscal cliff study group, you're very busy, but within 14 days, is that reasonable? Can you reply to them and CC the letter to us? So that with due respect to Professor Rousseau, he may be charming and slightly idiosyncratic and whatever, and he entertains us, and he's very good. However, he, like everybody else, can't come and say the same thing over and over again. So I'd like to suggest we reply to him, and next time we tell him, I will draft a letter to Bobo Allen, that please don't repeat what you said before, but take issues forward. So on SACU, we're pleased to see there's been some improvement, but, you know, fuller answer so that it's dealt with, right? Keeps raising the same issues. Secondly, on contingent liabilities, Michael, I'm a chair, I have no choice. I mean, if people ask for the information, you have to give it. In the quarterly report, can you raise to the DG? I've had a quick look, and whatever people say about Mr. Mania, he's got rights. Whether I agree with him or not, he's right. I followed up, by the way, after Mr. Mania. You're not giving the information. Can you alert your DG? We're not going to accept that. Unless you can provide us a reason why you cannot give us that information, which is consistent with the Constitution and the legislative norms and rules. Then on the issue of, I would like to urge members, the point Tanti makes is correct. We can't discuss these issues in 45 minutes, right? So it'll be an issue that is there on the agenda for a while. And so it'll be inserted into the budget and so on, discuss what we can do if there's time. And remember now we have a deputy chair for the committee, effectively, who can also manage chairing the meeting, is to have a special session on this if there is appetite for it. But this, you're right, we can't resolve the issues here, and it's good it's come up. The idea is to encourage dialogue, as you know, Comrade Tandy. And there's no simple answers. And it's very good that PBO put the issue on the agenda. You might know, Michael, they're also talking about budget reform, and they're saying that infrastructure investment doesn't necessarily lead to the growth rates. I'm sure you're familiar that are projected. So those are two other issues that are going to come back to us, and then we'll encourage that dialogue. So there are three themes, Tandy. The next thing to say is that I would like members, before we part, for about 5 minutes, to give some idea of what they think should go into the report, as we often ask. In other words, between the research team and the two chairs, we're meeting now at 12:30 for 10 minutes. And we have to get the report done over the weekend and send it out to you by Monday noon if all goes well. So for my questions, I'll leave them. Thank you. Can you reply to what the civil society actors have said, PBO and the members? Thank you. Up to 15 minutes.
I wasn't going to... I'm not sure.
And it's great. And
yeah,
you can finish.
I mean, I the one direct question was about the stimulus plan. I can't really say much. We're working on ideas around that. And I think it's important to understand the word stimulus can have different meanings. We can, as Minister said in the speech, confidence is the cheapest form of stimulus. So you can have confidence-boosting measures that stimulate the economy by leading to more favorable investment decisions. You can have, I mean, I think the PBO also in their presentation were skeptical about the impact of microeconomic reforms or more broadly you might say policy changes. But where there are policy changes that open the path to greater investment, it can have a strong impact on growth in quite an immediate sense, especially if those measures unblock blockages to additional investment. So when we're talking about microeconomic interventions, it isn't necessarily kind of deep structural reform. It could be simply unblocking regulatory constraints that are, for instance, the one issue we've been raising for a long time is the MPRDA, that nobody's going to invest in that sector, or let me not put it that strongly. Investment, while you're not sure what the legislative situation is, you're going to think twice about investing in the sector. And something like that isn't necessarily a difficult structural reform. It's just concluding the policy certainty in that area could generate growth. Then, of course, there is fiscal and monetary stimulus, and I think, as honourable members say, those are big debates that certainly do need to happen more. I think on the Parliamentary Budget Office, as I say, I don't think there's a right or wrong. A lot depends on context, and
certainly I share some of the sentiments about the global response after the crisis. Interestingly, we were meeting the IMF yesterday. There's a staff visit on at the moment, and I was reminding them that because they of course were concerned about the need for fiscal consolidation, and I was reminding them that about 2 years ago, when the IMF issued this kind of changed perspective, their message in their Article 4 consultation a couple of years ago was raising similar concerns, quite frankly, as the Parliamentary Budget Office, and we engaged with them about the need to balance this dilemma, that if we don't consolidate and we face rating downgrades and interest rates rise and capital flows out, it can also have a detrimental effect on growth. So sometimes in the debates about the IMF or the debates that take place there in Washington, they're very focused on the Europeans and the Americans and the Japanese. And I'm not saying that that's what Siraj is saying. No, I'm just trying to put some context. But they're very focused on their big global picture. And how that articulates with our current situation is sometimes it's like we become contingent, collateral. There's collateral fallout on us because Christine Lagarde goes there and says fiscal consolidation has been too much. But whether that applies in our particular case is still an open question. It may well apply in the case of Europe, and probably we would all agree it does apply in the case of Europe, or did apply. But and there's been a backtracking in Europe away from fiscal consolidation. But if you look at the extent of fiscal consolidation that, for example, the UK government was embarking on, with intentions to reduce the size of the public sector to levels not seen since the First World War, that was their path. They've now backtracked. Now, we never had a program like that. We were simply saying, stabilize the debt. And again, on the 60%, we are not setting out the 60% as a... we have been quite consistent in arguing that it's the path, the trajectory, that is really important rather than the particular level. However, we now have a path of projection which doesn't see a clear stabilization. So we are saying, look, let's stabilize, and maybe 60% would be a sensible place to stabilize around. But it's not, there's nothing, if it was 59%, it would also be fine, or 58%. On the management, I mean, the table that Honorable Mania refers to, which is in the annex, which shows employment by level, we actually really wanted to separate this because if you put all level, management level 13 to 16 together and you see there's been this growth, the OSDs are professionals, so they're engineers and doctors. There's a lot of doctors in level 13 to 16 that they're not necessarily managers, is the point. So that's why we wanted to separate it. So there has been growth in the 13 to 16 level. Now, in case anyone hasn't become aware, I would strongly recommend that if you visit our website, we have posted a spreadsheet there which gives for every national department and many of the provincial departments the full-time equivalent headcount over the since 2006, the compensation budget since 2006, and if you divide the one by the other, you get the average unit cost of compensation in that department. So that spreadsheet, it's a resource that we just put there that anyone can look at, and you can see which departments have changed in terms of their compensation, their employment levels, and their average unit cost and such. So we will try and get more specifics on this, but I'm not sure whether we would, because that spreadsheet really, that's the information we would be relying on to answer your question. The current wage, PERSAL system, the payroll system, is not very helpful when it comes to analytics. So even producing this data set that we've put up there that relies on it, it's quite intensive work to extract the data and analyze it and put it in a form that's useful. I think, lastly, let me just make a comment about the process. That let me make two suggestions.
But go ahead.
So,
but before you do, in fairness, Kusato, do you want to say anything? Fine. Okay, then go ahead.
My proposal, suggestion to you is why doesn't the committee convene? It wouldn't be necessarily a formal part of the formal parliamentary process, and there may be a need for the formal parliamentary process to proceed as is. But it would be useful for the committee to convene a more workshop format where we can spend maybe a day or a day and a half at a venue of your choosing, maybe outside of Parliament, where we can bring some academics, maybe a greater civil society representation, to have a discussion that is not about writing a report or making recommendations to Parliament, but it's really just sharing information and educating each other, sharing perspectives on these things. I think an annual event of that nature would be, after we table the budget, for instance, convene workshops of civil society, where we present all of the same type of presentations and we invite the unions and student organizations and others to just have that type of a dialogue, and it's very much appreciated and it helps the national debate, so I would suggest that. The second point I would make is about the amendments to the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act. We had, the Minister of Finance had sent a letter to the chair of this committee and the Standing Committee on Appropriations, proposing, not giving technical proposals on how the legislation would be drafted, but really proposing a principle. And the principle is that we seem to have two budgets every year. We have a budget in October and we have a budget in February. And the same procedures and processes are applied to both. Is it worth considering that let's make the October process focused much more in depth on the fiscal and macroeconomic aspects of budgeting, and the February process focused much more on the appropriation aspects of budgeting, and you don't repeat the whole cycle twice in a year where you then have to adopt the fiscal framework within a very short space of time before the appropriation discussion. Essentially, you devote the post-MTVPS discussion to the fiscal and macroeconomic policy debates, and without much consideration of appropriations. And then in February, you maybe have a truncated process which just checks is the framework, fiscal framework and macroeconomic, in accordance with what you tabled in October. If it is, fine, you proceed. If not, maybe you have a shorter debate and a shorter time frame. But the February process is really devoted entirely to the appropriation, the specific appropriations. And then the last was in respect of the BRRRs. Couldn't it be that there's just a cut-off date? And we say to any committee in Parliament, you do your BRRR as and when you would like, from the executive's point of view. But the Minister of Finance will respond to BRRRs that are tabled before the 31st of July in the next budget. BRRRs that are tabled after the 31st of July will be for the next cycle, so that it doesn't become, again, a burdensome requirement.
Before people answer, it's my job to raise some of your new members. Actually, nothing you've said, Michael Sachs, except the BRRR story, to the extent, has not been discussed before, to remind members, right? So the difficulty has been, one, the rigid deadlines of the Money Bills Act, that where would you get the time? Look how fast we have to move, right? Last week Thursday, then appropriation is on Friday, we met on Wednesday, we meet again on Friday. Over the weekend, the two chairs are dumped with the responsibility to draft the report together with the initial draft. The recommendations have to be done by the chair. That's a political decision. It's not the staff's job, right? And then on Tuesday we vote, Wednesday we have a debate. So the Money Bills Act, one. Two, the workshop situation, we tried it. It was a dismal failure because attendance was extremely bad and it was embarrassing, right? But if people are committed, we can do it. But what's very good is this is something we haven't discussed. This is totally new, Michael. And the letter that the minister gave us, we have distributed to members. Now, Michael, we can ask if you could please come when we look at the Money Bills Act again, which is, when is it, third week or so of November? Okay, we're still going under that slot if we pass the insurance bill by then. If you can come, or we can connect with you by, speaker phone, because we don't have video conference. Having said that, members, now you're free to speak. It's my job to tell you we have discussed these things. It didn't work, but let's see how it's going to work now. Okay, who wants to speak? Right.
Chair, I insist, and I'm happy that Mike is supporting it. You see, for us to be comprehensive in approach, you need these engagements and debates. And it doesn't just become a session of engagement, but it even empowers those who have never had a platform to engage anywhere else with policy matters. So those who decided not to attend is their problem, but you'll understand why I say a different platform to engage is better than when we do it in this format. In terms of recommendations are on the basis of the very same issues that we will have discussed and agreed, because we will take an informed decision. But if you come and want to discuss, and for argument's sake, what Mike has said, that if you look at the expenditure reductions and revenue measures, there is an issue that needs to be addressed. Where do you discuss and expand that issue in its entirety? You do it where you dialogue and then say, in terms of the patterns of revenue growth, this is what it was. And in terms of expenditure reductions, this was what informed it. And you get COSAT to say why they believe you must not reduce expenditure. You will have Siraj saying, but why do you want to consolidate? And you engage them there, you give them the figures. When we make recommendations as part of the committee report, we'll have considered all the factors. So I thought it's on the basis of that. And now you are suggesting a process that after the MTBPS process, we need to discuss the macroeconomic framework and so on.
You want, yeah.
It's an issue that we will want to consider, but one thing that you did not say to him, Chair, is that some of the things lie in programming. That even if we can take that decision here, it will still need to go into programming that will take a decision how the structure of the entire parliamentary programming is. So you will sit here in a meeting and try to do that type of work, and then the bell rings, you run out, and then we seem not to be focused in terms of the figures of the future. So we need to have a very influential chairperson, and I think he's influential now, you know, so I don't know what is wrong with him. And I don't know what he wants us to, you know, sometimes he thinks that you are saying these things to him, Mike.
No, I've done it. Tati, that was so impressive. Where's the killing? So first time you're speaking like a whip, the practicality, she's absolutely right. Right? Now that she's a whip, you'll see how she's going to realize. Firstly, Michael, I don't care. I mean, it's right to say it's open, transparent. To get permission to meet outside Parliament today, especially with the stresses of the budget, almost impossible. Secondly, constantly programmed to change. These guys see conspiracy theories and the program is laughable, eh? It's unrealistic. Meanwhile, it's just that we've been told there's no more committee week. You know, one week before we told no committee week. Suddenly three-line whips, and we're running in and out. We've done it. She's the one that most suffers with the high heels. Right? But anyway, can I raise it, colleagues, that the one that really impresses me personally, Tandi and colleagues, we really need to discuss this, hopefully by the end of this month or by the first week of January, before the budget comes. The one thing I really like is your proposal. That's there, by the way, in your letter sent to you. Let's emphasize MTBPS, macroeconomic framework, budget appropriations. But then budget also means tax. So then we're stuck with the tax issues, right? I really like that, comrades. Can we think about that? And I want to say something. I also realize, colleagues, we're not doing our job properly. When I looked at the notes I've got, and I still complain about the minutes, there were a lot of issues that Frank Jenkins has not inserted, that we had suggested to him to insert. And when I raised it tentatively once, he seemed a bit bemused because I wasn't here for two of the sittings. So I think what we need to do is not plunge into amending the Money Bills Act. And here's another reason why. So can't you write us when you've got time? No hurry. even if it's after this month, because it's a busy month for you, you can write even a one page or one and a half page, embellish that. But also, if we can mandate him to look at that bill and suggest concrete amendments, Michael, that'll help us. And then we connect with you. The other thing I want to plead with is that we should not ask people to fly over, and I want Tebogo and Alan to come with proposals on how we manage. In fact, if we can't get video conferencing, we can get teleconferencing. So can we connect my cell phone onto a speaker and we can talk to people? Like, why should you come up for a half an hour input on that day? So we'll try to connect with you, right? So can I mandate the two of you on behalf of the committee to do that? You actually have a teleconference. Oh. Yeah, except that I didn't think you people have a teleconference. I thought about that, except you see, it has to be an open meeting. And sometimes you can't fit into National Treasury. How many can your room take? 15 is not enough, see. I know we've been there for study groups, but you know, 15, it's not doable, eh? But for now, can we agree on that? So can we thank you, Michael, for your ideas? We will consider them seriously. The third one in particular is very interesting. We'll have to speak to appropriations. I have spoken to Frank Jenkins, just to put it on record. Can I get some mandate for this? You see, this thing about people flying in twice for hearings. I was told, dear, I know you're very cheesed up about this, but think about it, because you've been objecting to it. Why can't we have public hearings back on back? Meaning, we have the fiscal framework hearings in the morning, and maybe the appropriations hearing in the afternoon. Or secondly, this is an issue we've asked you before, not you. We've said, why can't you reply on the same day? You know all the information. What is it that people say that you need 48 hours? You people said, no, you need time. There's another option I want to raise for you to think about and for members, right? Let's have the hearings in the morning. In the afternoon, you reply. Then you go home to Swanee, you know, to your offices. You don't have to come back. You guys have said no up till now. I'm not convinced you can't do it. You can have a lunch break and do it, right? Unless there's so many submissions that we spill over into the afternoon. Yes, Tandy?
We need to be careful about that approach, and I will make an example. If there's statistical information that they need to table to prove that, for instance, if Mike presented a very interesting statistical report about how jobs grew in the public service,
that
you won't be able to do. So it's
flexible. To make life easier, you're right. I wouldn't know what I'm saying. But it's possible to be staying overnight and deliver the following day. Those are options we can look into. We can confer with you.
There could be, but everything I've presented here is in the MCPPS. So I could have just pointed you to those graphs and tables. To the page numbers.
Our co-chair, he keeps pointing out, look at this page. He's very good at that, right? As you were speaking, and he does that often. Having done that, can I say that... Fine. Look at him. He's so, what's the word, swami? He's so, like, smart. Look at that smile on his face, right? But fine, let's move on. He's got his right to be swami and smart. There's no rule that says he can't be.
But, Chair, David doesn't really raise issues or questions related to the MCPPS. He asks political questions.
But he's got a right to ask political questions.
How do you expect Mike to speak on behalf of cabinet, for instance? And this is the type of questions that come.
Fine, can we move on now?
Let me make a forecast. When we get our replies on Sunday, Treasury are going to cut and paste public sector debt out of another BR book. And then we're going to have a fight, because that's not the reply to the question.
Fine. That's okay. Do what you're entitled to do. As far as we're concerned, Michael, you and your team have handled things well, very well. In fact, can we round up by this? Are there issues that members feel we should put into the report? Like three or four things. Tandy, yes?
Chair, the recommendations that have come up in the report is the balancing of the expenditure reductions and revenues that have been put in place. It's a key issue that I think came up, and I think it must reflect. And also the implementation of the tax policy to be consistent with how we want to raise revenue. Those are my 2 cents input that I want to make.
Say anything to guide the report writing?
Chair, I'll confirm with my colleague and we'll send you an email this afternoon.
All right, but remember that because it's a report voted on by the majority party and you almost always oppose it, you have a right to make, let's not discuss minority reports. I agree with them, the committee doesn't, and the powers that be don't, right? So you've got to pitch your proposals in a way that takes into account where the majority. For example, if you say, privatize SAA. We're not going to put that as a recommendation. So it's fine to do it, but you have to be sensible. You're not a majority party. So you could say, look, we would like privatization, but given that the majority party doesn't want it, these are some proposals we have in mind.
Chair, the anchor will not be the governing party. The anchor will be the Moneyball's act and the law.
I don't know what you're saying.
Oh, you allow David to do, Chair?
No, it is right. He's a member of this parliament. Can you show me, Comrade Chair, can you intervene here now? I'm getting a bit tired of this. Am I doing anything that's wrong?
No. They are speaking from a certain term of reference, as we do, as a majority party. We must accept that. That's democracy. If we like it or not, that's a reality. Chair, no, thank you for chairing.
Is David not having the right to make proposals? That's the question.
Yes, he can make a proposal.
And
in the NCLP, there's time for declarations. Yes, you must come and see how we do it. Yes.
Chair, David has got a right to make a declaration in the chair.
He's a politician. All right, fine. Yeah, co-chair, can you round up, please? Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you. Thank you for the proposal that we have a equilibrium, inviting other perspectives as well. And if I can throw the stone in the bush, let's do it before the 9th of February. I don't know which day is the sauna, but let's we do it before the sauna, because after that it's debates and you name it. There's some space to look at that program. The message from the MTPBS is we must restore confidence. If we don't get that, how are we going to get the economy growing? And the reality is December 2017. That's reality. And we must say it. The other very important thing that came out throughout the engagement since the minister's briefing, co-chair, is that we have to engage quarterly with the National Treasury to monitor the economic situation in South Africa. I know you are doing it in the Standing Committee, but definitely the Select Committee for Finance, in terms of the NCP program, will have to filter that in, and that we look at this as joint meetings. In one of our resolutions, we took, I think it was last year, that we have a subcommittee looking at economic growth. It was captured in our report. We can just go to that. Also to look at the fiscal position of each province. There is some red lights flickering in some provinces because we were there as NCOP. So with that, Honourable Chairperson, thank you for your chairing and for the inputs by the Honourable Members. Is there anything you want to add in announcement?
Remember, we've got a meeting with the staff, right? Yeah. About both committees, can you please come forward? Let's start moving on the report. I also want to echo appreciation to all the members and to wish you well over the weekend.
Meeting is adjourned. The staff has just come.